Hi, everyone. I'm going to start this week's episode off with a deep cut from episode 11 of Opinion Science. There's some crossover between that episode and today's episode 95, so it plugs right in. I've also just always liked the way that intro came together, so I enjoyed listening to it again. I hope you do too. I'll see you back in a few minutes for what we're doing today. Earlier this year, I went to India. It was amazing. An experience that opened my eyes to just how much of my life in America feels normal, only because it's all I've ever experienced. With COVID-19 having, let's just say, demolished the travel industry, I don't know how long it'll be before you get to travel again. But an experience like that is useful for anyone who's gotten used to the culture they grew up in. It shows just how much culture, people, surroundings, food, practices, habits, shapes the way you think and relate to others. Oh, by the way, I went to India with this person.
Hi, I'm Shali Goyal.
She's my wife. Shali's mom is from the US and her dad grew up in India. Even though Shali was born and raised in the US, her family's background presented a swirling mix of cultural influences as she grew up. A bunch of research in psychology has shown that cultures can differ in how collectivistic or individualistic they tend to be. In collectivistic cultures, people's identities are inextricably linked with the other people they're connected to. The emphasis is on one's responsibilities to others. In individualistic cultures, people's identities are focused on what makes them unique, and they're more focused on their own personal aspirations. Or, in other words...
Oh, they'll follow your bliss shit.
Exactly. In the US, people tend to have a more individualistic orientation. But in India, things are more collectivistic.
Yeah, okay. So here's what I will say, and I think maybe like I have been a little indoctrinated when it comes to this. I do not believe in this follow your bliss shit. And I'll continue to call it that. Because I think doing whatever you want because you have to do it without regard to anybody else, I find to be truly inconsiderate, but I also think it's like hard for me sometimes because it is a truly like American value.
And one place where this aspect, or any aspect of culture, comes out is in weddings. We went to India for a family wedding, and it was definitely eye-opening for me. It really highlighted for me why Shali wanted us to have an Indian wedding ceremony, in addition to our more American one.
Yeah, well, so it was really weird because my dad, I think, just assumed since we grew up in the US that neither of us would want an Indian wedding, which is crazy because I had only been really to Indian weddings until my friends started getting married. And like it represents a part of like the tradition and like the symbolism that I grew up with, because I do think like American ceremonies, it's like very much like the choices of the bride and the groom or whatever. But you cannot have an Indian ceremony without your family being involved, which is what you saw when you went to India, because even though Ashi is my really second cousin, she's considered like a sister of mine. And so because you're married and we're all part of the same family, which not technically an Indian tradition since I married into your family, but you know, they like you also were expected to like, you know, walk in with the bride as we were welcoming the groom's family and like part of the barat. And so like, there are just so many different steps where it really is like the joining of two families, not just the joining of two people.
You're listening to Opinion Science, the show about our opinions, where they come from, and how we talk about them. I'm Andy Luttrell, and this week, just like we did in episode 11, we'll explore how the cultures we're embedded in shape our opinions and what affects them. I'm excited to share my conversation with Aaron Barnes, assistant professor of marketing at the University of Louisville College of Business. Aaron studies how things like persuasion and branding depend on culture, and here's the other connection to episode 11. He's done a lot of that research in collaboration with Sharon Chavit, the guest on that episode. But it's all new stuff today, folks, because Aaron has some super interesting research on the kinds of norms that affect our consumer choices. Are you more likely to buy something that's a bestseller in its category or something that's the top rated in its category? Well, it depends at least a little bit on culture. So let's get into my conversation with Dr. Aaron Barnes. to kick us off, what can you tell me about the vending machine industry?
Wait. Where are you digging this question from? Like, how did you know to ask me about vending machines? Where did that go?
This is exactly the reaction that I hoped for. You have a remnants, I don't know, some old WordPress sites from probably 10 years ago of your own. You wrote about this. And so it sounds like from as a kid, you were getting your feet wet doing marketing work for the family business. And it was about vending machines. And that's why I just wondered, like, what is digital marketing for vending machines look like?
Well, shoot, you're talking about culture, right? We got to look overseas. They're doing it the best. You go to airports in Japan or Singapore, and these vending machines are really high tech, sophisticated, with all types of products and things like this, right? That we, in America, we borrow from. We look to them for inspiration. Let's be clear. Like, I don't keep up with that industry these days. But that was how that did kick me off into exploring business and marketing. Man, my dad, God, he had my brother and I. We were eating them out of House and Home, my brother and I. And he was like, "Look, if you guys want to eat so much, like, you should get into this business so that you can, you know, take some of the cream off the top." And we were like, "That's a thing? Like, you could do that?" He was like, "Yeah, like, you don't want to necessarily eat yourself out of the business, but if you had profits, you could buy your own food." Like, that was the value he was trying to instill in us. So he named the company Aaron Specialties to, like, give me some psychological ownership of it. He's a, you know, intuitive psychologist himself, I guess, and had us doing direct marketing in our living room, licking envelopes, putting brochures in the envelopes, sending them out to different businesses to say, "Hey, consider us for your break room," right? I was eight years old at the time. So when we're in the living room, it's my brother and I were watching Samurai Pizza Cats, because that's what we were into, licking these envelopes. And then once we had a couple people who quit and said, "Yeah, we want your vending machines," it was my brother and I's responsibility to go around servicing them.
What was the, at its biggest, what was the fleet? How many vending machines are you talking?
Three.
Okay.
We're talking about three. I mean, look, I was eight. My brother's 6 years older than me. He was 14. So we were riding around on bicycles to go and service these things after my dad installed them with boxes of candy in our bags. If we needed to refill the sodas, and then my dad had to get involved. And eventually my brother got a license so we could drive around with the sodas and stuff. But yeah, it's a small business.
But it's to do it from nothing takes work. Like, even if it's three, like, to get that moving, like, is a real feat, I feel like. And your dad, was this in character for him to be like, "Well, why don't you just start a business?" Is that like a family value?
So he and my mom, they owned pharmacies. So I'm born in Los Angeles, and in Los Angeles, my mom's a pharmacist. My dad was the business manager. They owned these pharmacies called Firestone Pharmacies. This is back in the Wild West of, like, pharmaceutical drugs, where, like, you know, these were family owned businesses. Like, there was no such thing as, like, Walgreens and Rite Aid dominating the pharmacy scene, at least in California at that time. And so you had these mom and pop stores that could be really niche, really community focused. And that's what they did. And when we left California, that business was also left, that business, but the values of being entrepreneurial and kind of getting it yourself, that stuck with us. So in fact, like, I'm the youngest. My brother is the next youngest. My two older sisters, they were also involved in the business. It was a janitorial service. They were cleaning hair salons because, yeah, they were getting their hair done all the time. So my parents had the same idea, like, "Hey, you spend a lot of time in the salon. Why don't you clean them up, you know, so you can help afford your hair care?" And so that was, but neither of them are in the hair business. It was just that value of, like, okay, how can I, you know, supplement my existence? You know, how can I just carve out a niche? How can I add value? That kind of thing.
And this, I mean, this wasn't a one-off, right? Like, it's not like that's the end of the story. I serviced three vending machines and my entrepreneurial days were over. Like, that actually seems like it kickstarted something for you.
That kickstarted things for sure. So that, of course, led me to be the kid selling candy at school, which I got in trouble for. But also led me to be in online. Like, I was, man, I remember having a conversation with my parents about selling on eBay when I was 13, because they were like, "Hey, the actual age you need to be is 18. So we're going to have to, like, Be really careful with you operating with these adults out here. But it seems like you got, a decent plan. You're wanting to buy these hats wholesale and then sell them for a little bit of a markup. They were the sock hats with the brim. I remember giving my grandmother some because she was the influencer back in those days for me. but yeah, they were like, you just got to be careful on here. And they were monitoring, of course, and all that. But yeah, various different enterprises that I got involved in since then. Just didn't stop there.
So that was that. So you were, so that was, this is all still like pretty small potatoes, right? Like, I wonder as like a, now a professor of consumer research, do you ever look back on those days and go like, oh, I was actually doing something right? Or like, how could I have thought this was going to work?
Yeah, I think about that all the time and bring it up to my students to try to validate their experiences, right? They're like, look, this doesn't have to be the end all be all. Like it wasn't for me. I don't own a fleet of vending machines, but it was, for one, it gave me a ton of confidence to pursue anything, right? Like it almost didn't matter what I did. If I had experience as an 8-year-old effectively ultimately getting somebody to say yes to putting my vending machine in their business and then servicing it for a period, it's like that's hard to shake. So then when you face X next thing in the future, like that helps you kind of persist. And so like that's on top of, whatever business lessons I learned from any of those experiences, like selling. Are you familiar with the Taste of Chicago?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I grew up outside Chicago.
Oh man. Okay, so you're familiar with Wabash Street and like the wholesale district in Chicago. Is that a thing that
Roughly,
you
yeah.
not okay rough yeah so I was maybe 11 12 went to Wabash Street and got a bunch of like glow sticks flashing fans and th things of this nature to go and sell at the Taste of Chicago person to person. Like that was the kind of kid I was. I wrote my cousin into doing it with me and he was not feeling it. But I was like, look, man, if we could just sell a couple of these, like we can pay for our stay, we can get some shoes, like it could be really fun. You can meet some people. And like, so I mentioned that to talk about elements of just selling that then becomes something instrumental I talk about and bring up in class, right? Where again, it was more about the confidence that it built and validating those as business experiences, though they're not grossing millions of dollars, it does give a foundation to then pursue whatever you want.
Is this so? I guess so. I'm not familiar with the wholesale district here. Is this, are you saying like there's just a place in the city where everybody knows you go here to pick up a bunch of stuff that you can go sell elsewhere?
Yeah, I don't know the extent to which everyone knows, but there's definitely a district, at least at the time. There was a district. It seemed like every store on a couple of different blocks was selling something at bulk, and so bulk level prices. So it would have been like if the Sam's Club or Costco was made individualized on a block, right? Where anything that you were looking for was available for bulk.
And but eventually this ends up like you go into this more formally, right? Like you get more formal training in how this all works. And it's kind of, we don't have to unpack the whole story, but eventually you end up like what then brings you to do like I'll do the research side of it, like, because eventually that's where you land, like in a PhD program in, was it marketing or advertising? I forget what the name of the program is, but like why that? Like why did that seem like the obvious next step?
So, man, that actually started because of a scholarship I was awarded in undergrad. And that partnered me with a marketing professor from day one, where he made it his mission to kind of make clear to me that that job was not just teaching. Like I came to him with already an interest in teaching because I had been like a tutor. My parents worked in education, at least, and my mom did in Kokomo after, of course, leaving the pharmaceutical industry. She then worked at Indiana University, Kokomo. But so I was already kind of leaning like, ooh, teaching is cool. And they partnered me with a professor, so I'm gonna learn how to be a good college teacher. And he was like, look, man, this is what we actually do on the backs. Like, so his name is Adam Dohachik. I don't know if you know this guy. He's a great, interesting guy. Love him to death. And he pulled back the curtain of like this mad scientist world where we're running experiments. I remember doing experiments with like eye tracking devices back in, no, this is the late 2000s, like early 2010s. And so this was like cutting edge at the time. We're like, we're doing all this to figure out why people buy stuff, man. Like, this is what this is for. Like, this is so cool. Like, and that experience coupled with my lived experience of like trying to get people to buy glow sticks or candy, it's like, oh man, I can use all of these different techniques and tools to really dig into the psychology of why people buy stuff. I want to do this. And that was made clear to me by the sophomore year. So I knew then that I wanted a PhD. He had convinced me. I'm like, ooh, lifestyle, the work that you're doing, you seem like this cool guy. I want to do that. I want to be that. And, you know, so I was applying to PhD programs in undergrad. That didn't go so well, though. That didn't go so well. First time out, I was applying in undergrad. I didn't have a ton of research experience. Like, I was working with him a lot, but it wasn't any of my own stuff. I was just kind of an RA. And my application strategy was unsophisticated. So that just didn't work out. So I had to go and work for a little bit in between time, told them about my goals and stuff, but still wanted to kind of inform my capacity as a teacher with more practice. So that's why, and because I needed to make a living, let's be clear about that. but the whole time I'm working there, I'm thinking like, how can I leverage this to make myself a better applicant for a PhD program? So then, and that was while I was out in New York, and applied to Illinois because of Sharon, because of Tiffany at the time, where it's like, ooh, they're working on really cool things that speak to me. And if I can, what I learned from my first time applying to programs was about the importance of fit. Like, it wasn't, I was way too interested in going to the most prestigious school when I was an undergrad, because that's how I determined quality. Was just like, oh, if it's got a really high MBA ranking, that'll be the best place to get a PhD. And there's some correlation, obviously, but was it the right fit for who I was as a budding doctoral student? Maybe not. And they probably assessed that out. They probably assessed that out and like, nah, not this cycle. so yeah, that's how I ended up coming back to study this formally in the doctoral program. It was from that experience in undergrad kind of just pushing me along and guiding my steps for the next several years.
So you said you were interested in Sharon, this is Sharon Shavit at Illinois. Was that because you already had an interest in culture, or did that not really land until you found yourself in her lab or working with her?
No. You're right. Yeah, it culture specifically, I didn't like verbalize and really face my interest in culture until I got to Illinois. Like, I knew of her work because of the master's program that I was moonlighting while I was working in New York, and like became aware of her work and Tiffany's work, and was like, that's interesting, that's cool. And even that work that I'm talking about was not cultural in particular. It was more of the attitude stuff, the persuasion stuff that she did, and Tiffany's was more of the branding kind of stuff. And then when I got to Illinois, it was a mix of Sharon's work and Madhu Viswanathan's work, actually, that kind of made me realize how important it was to me to be inclusive. It's because part of my experience in undergrad, I mean, in growing up, was just kind of navigating these spaces of feeling excluded, wanting to be included, and doing whatever I could to try to include others once I felt like I was included. In her research, kind of opening up theoretical perspectives and applications from different, more or less excluded perspectives, right? This idea that what would work in the United States just may not work other places. Like, that's the story I remember her telling us in lab. Like, same pill back in the 90s, he broke that to me. And I'm like, he taught you this? Like, and you guys worked? I'm like, wow, you know. And that, you know, that inspired me to think like, so there's a way even to do this work of inclusivity, theoretically, and through academic research, that can be engaging, it can be insightful even, it might force us to go back to really old ideas and kind of reconsider them and to be smarter about them. And that's kind of how my dissertation came out to be. It's like, I was thinking of, in this paper in particular, it's like, I was thinking about myself shopping and looking at, you know, different tags out there, different cues, and I'm like, well, they seem interchangeable, like at least where I sit, they seem interchangeable. And then I'd start digging into it, and it turned out to be that businesses were kind of seemingly indifferent with the labels that they were using because of what we ultimately kind of unpack is this tight relationship between a Western idea between one's attitudes and behaviors. And it's like, but that wasn't even true for me as a kid, like, or me and my relationship. And of course, learning from Sharon, like you can, Sharon and other cross-cultural researchers, that interdependence is a value and a dimension that spans beyond just one cultural category. Like it's a dimension that could differ across individuals. And that kind of language, that kind of understanding of how people differ was the tool that I needed to help talk about some of these experiences that I had that I felt excluded from the literature at the time. And so really long-winded answer, I'm sorry about that. But that's kind of how coming to Illinois and then learning from her kind of gave me the voice, gave me the language to talk about my life experiences that I thought I didn't even have the language to express or articulate at the time.
Yeah, that's great. And to make it especially clear, and maybe as a vehicle to kind of unpack like what this cultural dimension is that seems to matter, like what is it about the way we have typically understood consumer behavior that's not that inclusive? And like what additional perspective do we need to adopt culturally to make that research more inclusive?
Yeah, it's a predominance of the weirdness of the data mostly. Like that's the most prominent idea in my mind. So that's not my idea. I came to learn about this paper in the program. And that again gave me more language to kind of articulate this feeling that there was so much focus on white people. There was so much focus on Western culture and all of our ideas, it seemed, spawned out of that basis of theorizing. And while true in some cases, some contexts, it appeared less prominent, it appeared less focal, the experiences of people when they are in different mindsets or in different contexts. So different compared to independent, a more interdependent one where we have to navigate and negotiate your own preferences, your own feelings, your own behaviors with those of others. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That is just the thing. Like that's what we're doing right now is we're not prioritizing ourselves. And that resonated with me a lot. I'm the youngest of four, so I had to do a lot of that growing up, right? And it's like, you know, I might have, this accessibility paper came out of this experience that is like a core memory for me of like always wanting Burger King fries. I remember like always wanting somebody, one of my older siblings to take me to go get Burger King fries. And it's like, I could tell you, if you asked me what I want, I could tell you right off the bat. But like, I know that no one's going to budge, no one's going to act on it. So I will modulate what I say that I even want to something that's more accommodating, right? As a kid, this is an experience that I remember having and being really frustrated by this. And that was something brought to life from one of Sharon's papers in, I think it was Psych Review, about preferences not necessarily being personal, where it's like, I'm expressing and holding these attitudes about other things besides Burger King fries, which is what I really want. And then talking to my older siblings about these things that they might want, and now I'm having these attitudes as well. So anyway, it resonated with me, those ideas. And that perspective, it felt, the perspective that I had, it felt was not represented in the literature at the time.
Because it seems like marketing theories at the time would have held the idea that like, well, if you want Burger King fries, like you're just going to say it, right? Isn't everybody going to voice their own opinion?
Absolutely. It's a cultural value to be kind of self-reliant, right? And to use those attitudes as an instrument of agency. Like you, why are you doing something you don't like? Is like a sentiment that's deeply American. Like if you don't like your environment, if you don't like your situation, change it, right? Like act on it. Like you're not just some thing in the environment that's swayed from point to point. Otherwise you're a sheep, or otherwise it's something that's disconnected with the American ideals. And it's like, okay, fine. But what about when you're not? Or what about when it actually feels good to be swayed by others, or and so on?
So of the things that could depend on this cultural perspective, the cool new work that just came out that you did has to do with like the cues that people turn to as like a quick way of understanding, like, what is it that I should buy? Like, should I buy this or should I buy that? And so I'll just hand it off to you. Like, what are those kinds of cues like that people are turning to, and why might they mean different things to different people based on their background?
Yeah. So open your Amazon, man, and you'll see top rated and bestseller all over the place. I mean, any online platform has versions of those kind of cues, basically telling people that a lot of people feel a certain way about this thing. And like, to us, or to people from independent cultures, I should say, in the Western side of things, like we were talking about earlier, like, what's different between something that people like versus something that people buy? Like, they should be the same thing. Like, why would I buy anything that I don't like? Right? And that idea that we should act on our preferences is something that's deeply Western, something that some of Sharon's old research and other cross-cultural research kind of points to as a big cultural difference, that there needs to be this high correspondence, a correlation between what you like and what you buy. Because if not, that just doesn't jive with our ideas of being a person, right? That's the definition of a culture, these ways of being, this meaning, what we identify as life, okay? And then it's like, well, in different parts of the world, at different times in your life, right? Different times of the day, even, you might be able to recall times when you might have actually done something you didn't like, right? And then that comes to, so for instance, my wife and I watch a bunch of TV at night because we got young kids, because during the day, what's playing? Bluey, yeah. You know, Peg plus Cat. And that's, so if you were to look at our records, right, if you were to check our algorithm, right, like it would say that those are most watched shows. Does that mean that I particularly like me, does that mean that I particularly like Bluey? Like, it's cool, it's a great show, but I'm not trying to watch that over the NFL, you know, playoffs or whatever.
Yeah, my Spotify suggestions are shot because I have a toddler.
Yeah, I mean, because what do? We observe what people do, and then we infer that because of what you've done, that you like it. That's seemingly natural, normal, right? Especially in a place that kind of has this tight link between what you prefer and what you do. And so that then got me thinking about this term bestseller, which we see all the time. There are bestseller lists, bestseller cues, like I was just talking about on places like Amazon. And it's like, sure, in independent places, in independent cultures and contexts, that might mean the same thing as something that's top rated. It might communicate the same information because of how we're socialized to view those two concepts, people's attitudes and their behaviors. Then in other places, and in more interdependent ones, that behavioral stuff might get interpreted differently. It might not necessarily lead the interpretation that the reason why it's a bestseller is because other people like it. Because when you're in that interdependent mindset, or in a culture that's interdependent, it's clear to you, or it is more salient to you, that that might not really be what people prefer, or at least I'm not so ready to assume that. Now, if you tell me that it is, that cue is directly pointing to other people's preferences, that is clear. And we know that that's influential in interdependent places because of this very phenomenon that we often do things that we don't like. So now when you're expressing to me something that you do like, I'm paying attention to that. I'm persuaded by that because I don't see that a lot. I don't get to experience that as much. That's the story that we tell in the paper. And that's how the idea about it came about, from kind of building on this idea that just the link between people's preferences and behaviors and actions might be culturally different.
And so you mentioned Amazon. Like, you've actually looked at Amazon data, like to really kind of establish that, like, no, this is a viable premise, that like best-selling and top-rated, that their connection to each other depends on where we're looking. And so, like, what did you have to do to get to that insight?
Man, so the first instantiation of that was me literally hand coding, going to Amazon in the United States and in India, and looking at heart rate monitors. I was trying to find a product category, so like Fitbits, stuff like that, right? And I was trying to find a product category that wouldn't have these really different cultural meanings, right, in the different places. And hand scraping, I can't even call it scraping really. I was just like clicking, but the price information, the rating information, the bestseller rank of the product, and then trying to assess the correlation between the product's bestseller rank, so how much people were buying it, Amazon calculates that, and then its five-star rating, so how much people were liking it. And some older research that was looking at green behaviors assessed people's self-reports about their attitudes and behaviors, finding this similar cultural difference that, like, in America, if I say that I have a positive attitude towards recycling, then I also am more likely to say that I recycle. And that correlation is stronger than in places like China or Japan, right? And so there was precedent for this, but not with actual behavior and actual ratings. And that's what made ours kind of another contribution, that we're looking at what's actually going on Amazon into independent and interdependent places, or I should say one of each, and showing that that same effect bore out, that the best rated products were absolutely the most purchased in America. But there was no relation in India. And that was like...
It really was zero?
Oh, we got them now. It was no effect.
Wow.
It was no effect, right? Exactly. That was exactly what I was up like. Wow. I thought that, like, okay, we're looking at real data. There's going to be some correlation. It's just going to be weaker.
Right.
Right, you can moderate it, and you can show a big, larger effect. That's fine, but I didn't think it was going to be null, and it was null. This was after, by the way. I told you my first try at this was just me hand scraping. We got smarter about this. Reviewers were like, "That's not going to fly. You need multiple product categories. You need a more transparent and systematic approach." So we did that and replicated it again. We were like, "Oh wow." This is, and that wasn't even our core effect or hypothesis, right? Because we were comparing just two different types of cues. This is more of just a theory building piece, like a proof of concept kind of piece of data to say that, look, if it's the case that there's this weaker correspondence between attitudes and behavior, then we should see a difference between consensus cues that prioritize others' attitudes versus behaviors. So then when we saw that, we were like, oh, we got them. We got, like, this is, Even though we didn't expect the null so much, but when we did, we were like, "This is compelling. At least it should help how to make this point very clear."
And it kind of suggests, I mean, the open question that you probably can't answer is like the sequence of things, like what came first, the ratings or the buying behavior. But it could mean that, like, in India, people are buying products regardless of how they're rated, right? Whereas in the US, they're buying products because they're rated more highly, or vice versa, where it's just like, oh, I like rate the product irrespective of whether people buy it or not.
Oh, yeah. No, so you're spot on. And just to kind of peel back the curtain of that process of where to put that finding. So at first, that was like a motivation kind of a demonstration to say, look, this is a real thing because these two things differ. And because of its place and kind of our theorizing, we thought that it should go sooner in the paper. But because of these questions that those data bring up but don't answer, the editorial team suggested, like, hey, maybe this should come after you've kind of made your point that is kind of removed from this order question, because it's just experiments showing one message versus the other message, not conflating that with what could be sneakily hiding in the result that you show in Amazon. So let's put that closer to the end to kind of wrap this up and say, this is a manifestation of, if it's true that these two things differ, then we should also see. It's kind of flipping the order of presentation of the data so that we don't get into order of presentation questions, less so in that Amazon data. But you're right that's possible. So we had to acknowledge that in reporting it.
So these experiments help to clarify, like, what's going on. So what did those look like? Like, what does it mean to then go, like, okay, like, Amazon is what it is. It's the Wild West of just, like, people are doing what they do. But you wanted to get, like, real fine-grained and be like, does this actually change outcomes? Yeah. And does it do that differently in one place or another?
That's right. And so one study that we did went back to US and India. So we got participants from both places. We made up a product. It was called a lablet. And that was to kind of reduce how much prior knowledge people had about it and maybe using that information to make the decision. But we told them about this fictional product. And we said, hey, in one condition, you know, 81% of people really love the product. Really love the product. So that was the attitudinal kind of consensus cue. That was the top rated type of consensus cue. And then in another condition, these, of course, randomly assigned, people saw that people bought this product. So we didn't mention purchasing in the other condition. We just said that they love the product. So they might have tried it out, or they might have just read about it online. We left that to the participant to infer, to complete that missing information. And so we did that in both India and the United States, and then measured on the back end the willingness to pay for the product. And we, of course, set the bounds based on what those items cost on Amazon, so that was more realistic. And what we found is that the willingness to pay didn't differ across those conditions in the United States. So kind of in line with the tight coupling between others' attitudes and preferences, or and actions, rather, Americans were indifferent. It convinced them the same way to pay an amount for the laptop. But in India, there was a big difference, about a 28% difference in willingness to pay when the product was shown with an attitudinal consensus cue, when they read that this laptop is something that people love versus it's something that people bought.
So in that case, so that's great evidence that you're like, okay, I know which direction this thing flows. Like, this label means something different. Like to say this is top rated packs more of a punch than to say that it's a bestseller, because presumably, as you say, people see bestseller and they go like, okay, but like, it could be a bestseller and be awful. So that doesn't really do anything for me. But the thing is, like, both of the examples so far compare the US and India, which are two different places in a lot of different ways. So like, how do we know, like, what is it about the respondents in India that's translating into this, like, what these labels mean?
Yeah. So this is a problem that cultural researchers have to face a lot, where it's like, there's a million differences between India and the United States, or any two countries, if you were to pick them, right? And so here's, again, where the idea of a cultural dimension or some cultural values that might permeate across individuals as opposed to countries is really useful. And so what we did to try to alleviate that concern that this is just a country difference, what we did is we measured these cultural values. So prior researchers have created scales to measure these values in these cultural dimensions. And we administered those questions to people in the same country in the United States, right? The platform Prolific claims to give a representative sample. So we use that, and we asked about 300, or a little more than 300 people, these questions about cultural values and interdependence and independence. This is the dimension upon which we think the United States and India differ, importantly for our project. So we measured those values all amongst people in the United States to then say, could we see the same kind of effect as a function of this independence and interdependence? And we did, right? So this time we used Starbucks, a well-known brand that kind of flies in the face of what I was talking about, this fictional product. Now people have priors, but they're good priors. Like, they're good priors in the sense that Starbucks could be reasonably touted as a best-selling coffee brand, right? The Starbucks everywhere. And it could also be something that people really like, right? I've enjoyed a couple of Starbucks every now and then, right? So it could reasonably be either one. And then we said to people, look, in one condition, Starbucks is, you know, a best-selling brand that people purchase a lot. And in another condition, we told them Starbucks was a most loved brand that people really enjoy or that people prefer. And then we said, we have these $5 gift cards to Starbucks. How much would you be willing to pay for it, depending on what condition you were in, right? That was the only thing that differed in the experiment, was whether they saw that Starbucks was top rated or was it was best-selling. And people, again, were willing to spend 30% more. The interdependence, the people who rated themselves as having more of these interdependent, more collectivistic values, were the ones who were willing to pay more for this $5 gift card when it was shown as a top-rated, most-loved product versus the best-selling one. Whereas the people who measured high on independence, like individualism, there was no difference. Again, there was no difference. And it's like, Okay, so in the same country, when we just measure the values that we think differ across countries, we replicate the effect. And now we're starting to feel confident. We're like, and by the way, we told people that if you bid above a random threshold, you're actually going to get the gift card. So there was some incentive, right, to actually bid what you would be willing to pay. And we ended up sending people some money. It wasn't the $5 gift card, but it was the difference between what they said they were going to pay and then the top amount, so $5. And so that it was there was actually some consequence. And so we were starting to feel real confident by that point. We're like, okay, so we've replicated this thing in one country, measured the actual values that we're claiming to be the difference between places like US and India. And we see the same thing. Okay, maybe we're onto something.
So I'm curious too, like, do you get overall effects of these values? Because there's a case to be made that like interdependence should be like more interested in consensus regardless, right? Like, whereas, you know, your prototypical like independent individualistic American is like, I decide what's good. I don't care what people say. And so is there any hint of that? Or does it seem like everybody wants to know what other people think? It's just that, like, we look to different sources depending on how we think about attitudes.
It was not robust. So just like the main effect of culture that you're speaking to, like it emerged sometimes, but not all the time. And so what that says to me is that, like, yes, if we consider consensus as just the attitudinal form, we would see, and that's what prior research has done. They've considered consensus. That was another kind of point of a differentiation between our work and prior work, where they didn't split apart attitudinal behavior. They considered it all attitudinal. And if you consider consensus as just attitudinal, then yeah, you should see this main effect of culture because now we're focusing on the attitudes, right? But as soon as you include others' behaviors as a type of consensus, that main effect is not so reliable. It does not replicate as often as you would see it with the attitudinal.
But you're saying, so if we just look at top rated, there is a tendency for interdependent people, for whatever reason, to be more influenced by a top rated label than
That's right.
independent people. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So the other question I had in just thinking about the findings and like what they mean is, I know there's like at one extreme, there's this position that like attitudes as an idea are fundamentally individualistic, right? Kind of like what you were saying before, like all like this is about me figuring out what I like. And so I'm curious, when you find such a big effect of attitude agreement or opinion agreement on folks with an interdependent mindset, like what is it? Like, why is that informative, right? Because you could almost predict that you go, well, these are folks who shouldn't care, because they go like, I don't need to have like I'm not concerned with my attitude. And so I was just kind of wondering, like, is some of this just like, I need to know what other people think so that I can fit in to these, you know, opinion norms? Or is it more like kind of the old school social psych approach, where it's like, well, social information is just information, and I'm just seeking information that's diagnostic, and so I'm going to turn to this information as opposed to this other one?
Yeah, I would say it's more the former, where when it comes to, so for one, fitting in is extremely important to interdependence. And one could also argue that you could fit in by following others' behaviors, right? Like that's another kind of thing we use to make our research sound cooler, was to be like, yeah, one alternative hypothesis is that actually the behavioral consensus is going to be more persuasive to interdependence because at least I know what to do now. And so on the surface, I could look in line, in step with others. But what I think the implication is that a better tool for feeling like you're in step and fitting in with others is if we agree kind of on these internal feelings. Is if I at least know what it is that you feel on the inside, and I can conform to that, gives me a greater sense of potentially feeling in, which I think is another way of it could be another way of following this kind of research up. Is like, is that a better tool for interdependence to affiliate, to feel this harmony, to feel this connection with others? Our research would say yes and suggest yes. We didn't test that in particular. We kind of assume that to be true. Or I should say, we assume that as an implication of the finding that others' attitudes are now this better tool to connect with other people.
Yeah. It also makes me think about like the outcomes that you're looking at, right? The willingness to pay, or I don't remember what some of the other ones are, if there were other ones, but like there could be something of a match there too, where, you know, there's potentially a hypothesis where it's like, well, if I ask you like point blank, do you want to buy the one that everybody buys, or do you want to buy the one that nobody buys, but the people who do like it? I would almost imagine, like, put that way, people go like, well, I'm going to buy what people buy. Like, that's the norm. And it's less like, do you value this? How much do you value this? Which is maybe just more informed by, is this a well-liked product?
That's right. That's right. And that distinction, I think, helped us make a contribution, because there's some work that we referenced where they look at consumption, right? We didn't measure consumption in our study. We did measure willingness to pay and product attitudes. So again, this kind of evaluative outcome, not necessarily will I purchase the thing, even though that's partly true. Like, I had a field study run in front of an actual Starbucks that didn't make it to the final version of the paper because of reasons, because of low end is probably one of the primary reasons. But anyway, that had actual behavior and it was consistent. But what I'm saying is, Tu and Fishbach found something similar to what you kind of just hypothesized, right? They weren't necessarily focused on culture, but what they found was like people were more willing to conform in their behaviors with what other people did. Mm. I hope I'm remembering that right. Mm-hmm. What other people did. Yeah,
it makes sense. Okay, in the time we have, I do want to talk brand equity though, because that's a fun capstone to all of this, which is like another one of like, maybe you're going to tell me that you sat down and you just like hand recorded all this. I forget what the nature of those data are, but I actually am not super familiar with what brand equity is. So like this becomes a useful metric that you use to sort of tie the pieces together. Again, I'll just hand it off to you. Explain to me what that is and what you did with it.
So brand equity, maybe in the simplest way, is like imagine two products and you know nothing about them, like nothing at all about them, but one is $1 and the other is $2. And if all else equal, there's a brand slapped on a product that's $2. The equity of that brand is about $1, right? Because there's a premium people are willing to pay for just the name or the associations with that name that then has value. Like that's an economic way of measuring brand equity. There are these other like more psychological ones where people have these good feelings or different positions in their brain and distinctions between say Nike and Adidas that then give that brand equity, gives that brand value. And so that's become, as you might be able to imagine, that's really important to practitioners. Like we want our brand to have high, strong equity, right?
How do they measure that? Is that like they ask people that question, that scenario?
Well, not that scenario, but they do ask people, you know, how much more are you willing to pay, right? That's part of the reason why we use willing to pay in our studies. But what would you be willing to pay for our brand? Or they just look at, you know, purchase behaviors. It's like, well, you bought our brand when it was $100, even though there was an alternative for $50 or for $60. And you didn't buy that. So now we're going to infer that our brand has this equity of X dollars, right? But this is actually a really good point, because people also are in business telling other businesses how to measure brand equity, right? And so like those are the data that we acquired from VMLY&R. Sorry, I got that acronym messed up. Because part of their business is measuring brand equity in a global way across a bunch of different countries with people, measuring things like their preferences for the brand, their willingness to purchase the brand, their associations with the brand. So adjectives associated with the brand. Is this brand arrogant? Is this a good quality brand? Is this friendly? Is it on and on and on, 48 some associations that then they organize kind of like a factor analysis into five different pillars of brand equity. Anyway, that's a proprietary mix. Suffice to say, we just took their measure at face value and try to compare brand equity across countries using the indicators of people's actual preferences for the brand and their purchases of the brand, so the actual purchases of the brand, to then again see like what's the right indicator, what's the right predictor of brand equity in different cultural contexts, according to our way of dimensionalized culture. So independent and interdependent. So our data set had these eight countries, UK, Denmark, Canada, Germany. These were the independent countries. And then Mexico, India, Korea, Argentina. These were the interdependent ones. And Hofstede kind of bears this out with differences in individualism. Okay. So then we had these two groups of countries, and it was a simple regression. I'm actually stylizing. It was a more complicated thing. But think of it like a simple regression where we're just using as predictors the people's preferences for over 8,000 brands in these two groups of countries and their purchases, their reported purchasing of these two different brands. And like one school of thought is like, well, my brand equity is all about market share, how much people are buying my brand over others, like the example I gave you. Another school of thought is, well, it's not that I need everybody to buy my brand. What if I'm LVMH, right? Like, I don't need everybody to have a Louis Vuitton, right? It's more about the esteem, the regard that you have, these associations, right? And so then we ran the analysis to see if those preferences versus those behaviors were better or worse predictors of this overall brand equity. And we found that preferences and behaviors were equal level predictors of brand equity in those independent countries. So the UK's, Denmark, Canada, Germany, other world, they were literally like, we rounded to two places in the paper, but they were just about indistinguishable if you kept going with the predictiveness of others' preferences, or not others, my personal preferences and my personal purchases in predicting brand equity. Whereas in those interdependent ones, it was the preferences that was winning out, that was predicting brand equity more so than purchases. And again, that was something we wanted to include to kind of speak to marketers and say, like, this, an implication of this is might change your KPI, your key performance indicator dashboard. It's like, if you're tracking, market share and using that to understand your brand's equity in interdependent context, you might be missing the mark, right? Like, and which is, it's not necessarily even a bad practice, but it's not as precise, as at least our research would suggest it could be, as if we were measuring these more attitudinal measures of brand equity.
Is it as a corollary, is brand equity kind of like your brand's reputation or image, kind of like that? And so,
absolutely.
Yeah. So it seems like in Western contexts, a brand's reputation is just like people's like purchases and opinions, like just purchase plus opinion equals reputation. Whereas in more interdependent contexts, it's more like, well, your brand's reputation is really primarily about whether people like what it provides, mm-hmm. and not so much whether it's selling. And so to your point, you're saying like, you know, if I'm overly focused on tracking, like, how is my brand performing in terms of dollars and cents that people are like choosing to buy, I'm missing out on like a major component of like what my brand's image is in this place.
That's right.
When we're talking about an interdependent culture.
That's right. So let's be quick. Like, it was the case that the behavioral indicator did positively predict, like it was correlated with brand equity. So you would get there, right? But it's just, there was so much more variance explained by the preferential indicator. And it's like, if I'm that manager, I want to be as precise as I can be in trying to assess my brand's equity compared to others, right? So then I can figure out and allocate resources to try to grow or, you know, beat out competition. So yeah, that was just really fortunate that came out, because these are not data that I scraped. these came right from a company whose business it was to sell a brand equity measure, and they agreed to share it with Sharon because she's a cultural expert, and she was saying, we can offer some insights, some culturally based insights to help even you be more precise in how you're talking about brand equity. And we hope that that's kind of what people take away, is like there are these cultural differences that can make us even sharper in our ways of measuring these indicators and being smart about marketing.
What's nice too is like your finding is so fundamental, right? It's one of those things where it's like, it's about the thing everyone would have said is like the thing you'd pay attention to. It's just like, well, do people buy it? And you go like, that, even the most fundamental part of the equation is at the whim of culture. Like, you cannot build a global model of consumer behavior based only on like a slim segment of the global population. Like, it's not like, oh, there's some like fringe variable we forgot to include that we only get with a cross-cultural perspective. It's like, no, like the main one depends on this important outcome.
That's right. And I remember early in the days of this project, Sharon was reminding me of some really old work talking about the ultimate outcome of persuasion is changed behavior. And believe it or not, well, not that you would believe it or not, but maybe it's not surprisingly, that came from a Western perspective, right? That the ultimate outcome of being persuaded is if you change your behavior. And it's like, we didn't necessarily make this claim in the paper. We kind of softened our language. But in our conversations, we were talking about, well, is it? Like, is the ultimate outcome of persuasion change behavior if, in interdependent context, when you tell me about other people's behavior, that's persuading me less than telling me about other people's attitudes? It's still an open question. Again, another follow-up idea for future research is like, is there a way to demonstrate in different ways that the ultimate outcome of persuasion is something other than changed behavior? And like, what would be the implications of such a finding on what we, about our fundamental understanding of how people are persuaded, and how we know that people are persuaded, especially like now we're observing other people's persuasions. This is an interesting thought.
Right. It's funny. So I'm teaching an attitudes class now, and we were just talking about attitude behavior consistency. So, it's funny now to think of this in this context because, what was it, in the 60s, psychologists were like, you know what, forget it. Attitudes aren't predicting behavior. Why aren't they? They're supposed to predict behavior. Like, what are we even doing? But it's like interesting to think of that as like a reasonably Western perspective of like being bewildered by the lack of correspondence sometimes between attitudes and behavior.
That's right.
Whereas in another context, it would have been like, well, yeah, why would they? Like, why would they necessarily do?
No, that's funny. You're right. The bewilderment of the lack of correspondence. My Western upbringing came front and center when I was looking at those Amazon data, and I was like, oh wow, it's a null relationship. No way, I did something wrong. Like that was how I responded. I was like, I coded these data wrong. Like there's no way it's null, right? Like just bewildered, like disbelief that the top rated stuff was not also the best selling because of what even parts of me believe that sometimes it is the case, like at least to some degree, like it's gotta be, right? And it wasn't.
As by way of wrapping up, the kind of natural follow-up is then like, what's next? Like what's on the docket now? Like, are there things in the mix on this theme, or are we moving to new ideas?
So yes to both questions. So there's research I'm conducting now looking at like early stage research looking at kind of negative consensus. So what we focused on in this paper was the positive consensus, because that's usually what marketers focus on. Like we don't expect marketers to say like 85% of people don't like us, or you know, only 50%. But they're in different contexts, like news articles might present data in a way in the negative frame, and it's trying to understand whether or not people's inferences based on how negative consensus or cues about others' negative orientations towards something might then affect their persuasion. And I'm still early stage trying to figure out like what's important there, what cultural variables matter, because it might not be individualism, collectivism, interdependence, independence. It might not be, and that's okay. But I'm still like working on that idea, at least in the direct follow-up vein of this particular paper. Beyond that, in some of my other cultural work, I'm looking at this concept of maturity and how that affects people's willingness to share opinions. And so one idea that we've been tossing around is like, for one, what does it mean to be mature? Like, and does that culturally differ in this kind of traditional East-West differences? Because we were, my co-authors and I, we were talking about our experiences at like holidays and how like, you know, in some contexts, like it's the older people who are kind of like letting it rip, like letting anything fly and say what they feel, because that's what it means to be mature. It's like my ability to kind of express myself and say things because I've lived a life and I've kind of earned it, whatever, right? In other places, the sign or the meaning of maturity is not that. It's kind of this regulation, modulation, and kind of ease. So you kind of see, feel some of the same elements of my this prior work, this paper that we're talking about, where individual and collectivism is probably going to play a role, and that's what we suggest as well. But then we, from that, we built on like, so what are these cues of maturity that might happen in the wild, and how might that affect whether people are willing to share attitudes, and can we look at that across culture? Can we understand that better by looking at people in, say, Hong Kong in the United States and observing their willingness to share after being exposed to a cue of maturity? And indeed, we find that kind of pattern, that if you cue maturity, just to give just something as simple as what would a mature person say in this case, right? Like that gets Westerners to talking and disagreeing with people, huh. and it gets Easterners to pause and do less expression. So that's a sample of some of the stuff that's going on.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, I'll look forward to the day when it comes out, when you've got, you know, 25 studies on that coming out next.
I hope not, man.
But yeah, thanks so much for taking the time to talk about this. This was great to hear about.
Of course, man. Thank you so much for having me.
Alrighty, that'll do it for this episode of Opinion Science. Big thanks to Aaron Barnes for taking the time to talk about his work. You can find more about him by following the links on the episode webpage, as always. As for this show, you can head to opinionsciencepodcast.com for all the past episodes, ways to contribute to the show, links to other fun stuff, all thanks to the magic of the World Wide Web. Be sure to follow or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, wherever you like to get podcast noises delivered to your ears. You can find Opinion Science. Okay, that's all for this week. Thanks for being here, and I'll see you in a couple weeks for more Opinion Science. Bye-bye.